partly driven by a 22.1% annual rise in oil imports, the customer's data showed. Oil supplies from Russia totaled 7.46 million tons, equivalent to 1.82 million barrels per day, compared with 1.96 million BPD in August. As Western nations have shunned Russia, cooperation with Beijing has become increasingly important for Moscow. Bilateral trade has surged to $136.9 billion in value in the first 9 months, up 32.5%. According to Global Times, China-Russia trade saw a significant growth in September, with the total import and export volume reaching $18.65 billion, a year-on-year increase of 27.8%, according to data published by the General Administration of Customs, maintaining the strong growth momentum despite external challenges. Experts said the strong trade between the two countries mirrors the fact that there is a growing complementarity under free trade arrangements which benefit both countries, ranging from energy to food, as China and Russia carry out normal economic and trade cooperation on the basis of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit. In September alone, China's exports to Russia amounted to $7.99 billion, up 17.48% year-on-year, while China's imports came to $10.65 billion, rising by 35.55%. From January to September, China-Russia trade reached $136.8 billion, a year-on-year increase of 32.5%, with both imports and exports sustaining double-digit growth based on China customs data. Energy, bulk commodities, and agricultural food have been the main drive for the growth. The continuous expansion of China-Russia trade once again reflects the strong relationship between the two countries, experts said. For example, China's auto exports to Russia have increased significantly, filling the vacancy left by European and American firms as they quit the Russian market due to the political-driven factors, Song Kuo, president of the Contemporary China-Russia Regional Economy Research Institute, told the Global Times. In 2020, China became the largest export market for Russian agricultural products and meat, and experts predicted that the trend was set to continue. The energy trade has gained a rising foothold in the bilateral trade as Russia is placing more focus on the East in terms of energy supplies expansion driven by the West sanctions. Gazprom president Alexey Miller said Gazprom has been increasing gas supplies to China via the Power of Siberia gas pipeline, increasing volume by 60% in the first 8 months of 2022, according to media reports. With the implementation of the project, gas supply to China is set to increase every year, reaching a designed annual gas transmission volume of 38 billion cubic meters by 2025. While risks linked to the U.S. dollar exchange rate are mounting, China and Russia have facilitated their own currency settlement, which has greatly assisted in trade and advances the internationalization of the yuan, Song told the Global Times recently. In addition, the improvement of the infrastructure cooperation between China and Russia, including the opening to traffic of the first China-Russia highway bridge, which stretches from Hech, a border city in northeast China's Heilongjiang province, to the Russian city of Blagoveshchensk, spanning the river in June, has boosted the flow of trade. Song said China's economic development and huge market demand requires adequate, stable, and diversified energy supplies, while Russia needs capitals and a reliable market to support economic and trade growth, which is a win-win outcome for the both sides. Song said that Russia-China trade will maintain accelerated growth momentum, which is the result of the natural demand growth of the market economy and free trade.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. After two decades of deployments, drone strikes, and commando raids to fight Al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states. History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya have all been subject to U.S. interventions and are experiencing chaos as a result. In recent years, there has been growing recognition of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Despite its years-long military presence in Africa, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments. Since 2008, U.S.-trained African military officers have attempted at least 9 coups in 5 Western African countries. According to a report, 8 such coups, which took place in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Mauritania in different years, were successful. The failed coup was in Gambia in 2014. Confirmation is reported from the U.S. Africa Command that several African military leaders who staged coups in their countries participated in AFRICOM's flintlock exercises. Since 2015, 5 coups have been carried out by military leaders who had previously participated in Special Operations Command Africa flintlock exercises. The U.S. Department of Defense claims that these exercises, which were first conducted in Africa in 2005, are intended to strengthen the capacity of African countries to fight terrorism. But are they? Despite their claims, Americans have only been harbingers of more coups and more instability in Africa.
China seems to be going through a decisive change towards a one-man ruling system after several decades of power shifting. President Xi also has total control over the Politburo that he introduced among his closest allies. His power even extends to the military, as he also holds the title of Chairman of the Central Military Commission. In his most recent address to the CCP, President Xi pledged to pursue a very communist idea. He pledged to redistribute wealth to reduce inequality, as well as full employment. He also added promotion of gender equality, expansion of social security and healthcare, protecting the environment, and fighting the cancer of corruption as other items on his agenda. Despite the controversies that mainstream media tried to bring Xi into, China's current and future leader has been able to put the nation on a fast track to dethroning the U.S. as the world's number one superpower. But the U.S. isn't the only country that isn't enjoying the shift of power from west to the east. Josep Borrell, the representative of the European Union, whose recent mildly racist / elitist comments stirred emotions.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it.
Has admitted to the role that China and Russia have played in his garden's prosperity. He said, "I think that the Chinese workers with their low salaries have done much better and much more to contain inflation than all the central banks together." He also said, "Our prosperity was based on China and Russia, energy and market. Clearly today, we have to find new ways for energy from inside the European Union, as much as we can, because we should not change one dependency for another." This is not the first time that Ursula von der Leyen makes inflammatory or accusatory comments about China or Russia. She does still recognize the crucial role that China plays in European economy, though. In the follow-up of the EU-China summit that took place in late June, she said that the EU-China relationship is simultaneously, quote, "one of the most strategically important and one of the most challenging." Regardless of what the EU or the US or the mainstream media says about Xi Jinping, or the numerous criticisms they throw his way, China is not fazed or threatened. China's economic recovery from numerous challenges, including COVID, came much earlier than many big global economies. And so the best market for China's goods has now become China itself. As Borrell said, the EU is reliant on Chinese goods and services, and not the other way around. This is the reason why the EU, despite warning China not to trade with Russia amid EU sanctions, hasn't been able to take any decisive action against the Asian superpower. The US has also tried to undermine China through meddling in Taiwan's affairs. In fact, US President Joe Biden has made his most explicit statement so far on the issue by outright stating that US forces would defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. He was even asked to clarify if he meant whether American men and women, unlike in Ukraine, would defend the island, to which he replied, yes. Despite all the attempts made by US or the EU to undermine China, as Borrell stated, the EU can certainly look for domesticizing production and decreasing its reliance on China, but as it stands, the idea seems more like a distant dream than anything resembling an actual short-term applicable plan to get Europe out of the crisis it's in.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League. Another important development has taken place that cannot go unnoticed. Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, in which Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society.
the necessity of international action, as Israeli government's actions are seen by the commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the US.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we look at how Western governments have planned to stoke unrest in Iran, doing everything in their power to encourage rioting in the country. Please stay with us. Recent events in Iran have become a pretext for Western governments to interfere in Iran's internal affairs and to pour fuel on the fire of unrest in the country. During the past 43 years, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have used all opportunities and all means at their disposal to attempt to oust the Islamic Republic. In addition to the policy of promoting Iranophobia, both within the region and the wider world, they have also tried to smear the Islamic Republic, sullying Iran's reputation and portraying a very negative image of Iran through the media outlets that they control. It is obvious that the United States of America, Canada and Britain, and some other European countries are trying to bring about a velvet revolution or a colored revolution in the Islamic Republic, doing everything they can to cause unrest in the country. The enemies of Islam have used all sorts of pretexts and all manner of techniques to create a crisis within the country, including defending women's rights, human rights, how elections are held, the vetting of candidates, and creating doubt with regards to how votes are counted or tallied. Anything which can be used to split the population or create divisions and discord among the people is fair game, as far as the enemies of Iran are concerned. All these techniques and many more have been used at some point during the past 43 years to generate unrest within the Islamic Republic. The enemies are constantly watching out for an opportunity to present itself to stoke more riots and demonstrations. They plan meticulously for the next riot in Iran. Virtually all democratic nations face demonstrations and unrest, usually caused by the poor economic performance of their government, or soaring prices and soaring inflation, which outstrip wage increases quite easily, or rising unemployment, etc. But these demonstrations and protests are usually handled quite well and governments respond to the demands of their people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the most democratic country in the West Asia region. In the first year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, no less than 5 elections and referendums were held with the Iranian people casting their ballots in the ballot box at least 5 times in less than a year. The first of these was a national referendum on the type of government and governing system that we should have. The second was a nationwide election to determine the members of the Assembly of Experts of the Constitution. The third was a national referendum on a draft constitution drawn up for the Islamic Republic. The fourth was a nationwide presidential election. And the fifth was a nationwide parliamentary election to elect members of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis. It is worth noting the unprecedented nature of the first referendum in post-Islamic Revolution Iran. In no other revolution in the world's history have the people been asked to vote in a national referendum to determine the type of government and the type of governing system that they should have just 50 days after the victory of the revolution. The democratic credentials of the Islamic Republic are quite clear. In the 43 years which have passed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 40 nationwide elections have been held in the Islamic Republic. Few countries can match this level of participation by the general public in the running of their country. But it is also worth noting that some of the least democratic countries of the world are also located in West Asia, neighboring Iran. These dictatorial and totalitarian regimes, many of them absolute monarchies, do not have the support of a majority of their own populations. And yet, they invade Yemen and have killed hundreds of thousands of Yemeni men, women and children with weapons supplied to them largely by the United States of America and Britain. These same ruthless dictatorial regimes, neighboring Iran, have murdered dissident journalists and have imprisoned political activists and women's rights activists, but so-called defenders of human rights in the West have kept silent on these dreadful crimes. Western governments have failed to condemn these crimes, giving these dictatorial regimes, who happen to be client states of the West, just a simple slap on the wrist. The Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, is treated very differently by the West, which shamelessly pursues double standards in the West Asia region. Britain and the United States, in collaboration with certain dictatorial regimes of West Asia, have established dozens of Persian language broadcasters who air disinformation and lies and give a very biased coverage of events in Iran. Broadcasters like Iran International, BBC Persian, VOA, Voice of America, and Manotor. The purpose of these broadcasts is to cause a rift between the Iranian people and their government, and to create unrest in the country. Every pretext is used to stoke tension and unrest within the Islamic Republic. The tragic and untimely death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, was used to bring about unrest in the country under the guise of defending women's rights. It is worth noting that an autopsy and coroner's report in relation to the tragic death of this young woman states quite clearly that no acts of violence of any kind have played a part in the death of this young woman. In fact, according to the coroner's report, Mahsa Amini had a history of stroke and heart attacks, and this was what ultimately caused her death after she went into a coma. Concurrent with Mahsa Amini's death in mid-September, a horrific act of terrorism in Kabul, Afghanistan, claimed the lives of dozens of young girls and children. Rather shamefully, not one Western government or Western human rights organization expressed any sympathy or any condolence to the families of the victims of this horrific terrorist attack. This tragedy in Afghanistan apparently went unnoticed by Western governments and Western human rights organizations. However, mainstream Western media, including the Persian language broadcasters which go on air in London, have given maximum media coverage to events in Iran. As usual, putting out misinformation and outright lies and pouring fuel onto the fire of unrest. In just about any country in the world, the police and security forces arrest rioters and those who damage public or government property. Just about every night, police forces throughout Europe arrest rioters and demonstrators who damage public or government property. But when Iranian police and security forces do the same, this is somehow seen as unconventional or something unusual. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed in a two-polar world. We overcame both the East and the West. The Islamic Revolution triumphed with the support of the Iranian people, and this support remains steady and steadfast up until this day.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Our Lord, forgive us, pardon us. Our Lord, we want only your reward and your forgiveness and nothing else. And toward you is the return. We are going back to you. There are many important things to said about returning to Allah that we will, inshallah, explain in this series of lectures when we come to the topic of the resurrection in the Quran, if Allah grants us the opportunity until then. So what have we understood from these verses so far? First, that faith and belief are two qualities possessed by those who answered the call to submit to Allah. Those people who have no faith, who have no belief, who just followed everyone else to be on the safe side, they are not within the domain of Islamic thought. There is no shame in saying so, because faith is necessary. Faith means belief, to accept what is clearly and unimpeachably true. It means attaching oneself to a cause. If this cause is not the thought of the religion and the Quran, and your heart will not be subdued, meaning if there is no faith in this heart, then this heart is a dead heart. It does not live in the light of Islam. It can never be called a submitting heart, a Muslim heart. Therefore, faith is necessary. This is first.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Second is that faith is of two varieties. There is the faith of those who blindly follow because they have a tribal mentality. Their fathers and grandfathers believed, so they believe as well. Because our holy scripture says this, because our religion says this, we say the same. And even if you bring them evidence to the contrary, they will never listen to you. This is one kind of faith or belief. But even this has two kinds. There are those who blindly follow taqlid, like most people today, such that if you ask them, how do you know that the Prophet of Islam was true? They have no idea what to say. They don't know anything. Their forefathers said so. Their school teachers said so. The people they see in the streets and markets says so. So if all of these tell them that the Prophet was true, they will say so as well. Now they believe, they really do believe that the Prophet was true, but this is just something they heard from someone who they trusted and blindly accepted without checking for themselves. Similar to the belief of those who blindly follow is the belief of those who follow tribally, ta'assub. Some of these people are ready, may Allah protect us, to insult other prophets to please our Prophet. They think that these prophets are fighting one another in the heavens.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Inflation is continuing to rise in America and prices move faster than increases in salaries of employees and workers. Problems in the supply chain, the war in Ukraine and high demand for consumers have kept the prices of goods in the United States at their highest level in the past 40 years. In a report, CNN says that inflation is rampant in the United States and the central bank's tool to fight price increases is to set higher interest rates. This makes borrowing more expensive and slows down the US economy. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The New York Post has covered this story. An analysis from the Heritage Foundation showed the average American has lost $4,200 in annual income since President Joe Biden took office. Experts at the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, say in a recent report, the losses come down to surging inflation and higher interest rates. Their analysis found that the average American has lost about $3,000 in annual purchasing power because consumer prices, which have risen 12.7% since January of 2021, have spiked significantly faster than wages. Wages have risen just 8% over the same period, which has effectively resulted in a pay cut for Americans struggling to pay for daily necessities, including food, gas, and rent. Higher interest rates and borrowing costs have also reduced the average person's purchasing power by another $1,200. E.J. Anthony, a research fellow in regional economics with the Heritage Foundation Center for Data Analysis, says, simply put, working Americans are $4,200 poorer today than they were when Joe Biden took office. E.J. Anthony added, this financial catastrophe for American families is a direct result of a president and Congress addicted to spending our money, combined with a Federal Reserve compliantly enabling this addiction by printing more dollars. He added, now the U.S. Federal Reserve is finally fighting inflation, which is pushing up interest rates and increasing financing costs. Rates on all kinds of consumer debt are rising. Mortgage interest rates have doubled since Joe Biden took office, greatly increasing Americans' monthly payments. Concerns about persistent inflation were renewed recently when federal data showed consumer prices had increased 8.3% in the month of August, compared to the same month 1 year earlier, a figure that was worse than what economists had been expecting. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. US Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell warned recently that there would be pain ahead as the US central bank struggles to contain a surge in inflation unseen in the past 40 years. US Federal Reserve announced another sharp rise in interest rates on Wednesday afternoon, 21st of September, after the conclusion of its meeting. It also updated its economic forecast for the U.S. economy. Economists say the Federal Reserve raised its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage points, the third such rise in a row, and plans to raise interest rates again in the coming months. The hike comes as central banks around the world are increasing rates to tackle a soaring cost of living crisis. Last year, the U.S. Federal Reserve dismissed inflation as a transitory issue, triggered by the pandemic and supply chain issues. But consumer prices have remained stubbornly high and have remained so despite a change in the U.S. Federal Reserve's view and its aggressive interest rate rises. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced recently that prices were 8.3% higher last month compared with August of last year. The U.S. Federal Reserve's target rate for inflation is 2% annually. That news has led some to speculate that the U.S. Federal Reserve could increase interest rates by a full percentage point, a drastic move for an institution that usually moves rates cautiously up and down by just a quarter of a percentage point. The sharp rise in interest rates are aimed at slowing the economy and bringing down prices. Higher interest rates have fed through to the housing market, where rates for a 30-year mortgage have now passed the 6% mark for the first time in the past 14 years. Until recently, Jerome Powell had suggested a soft landing was possible for the economy, in which rising interest rates would bring down prices without causing a severe financial downturn. But at the annual meeting of the central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, last month, Jerome Powell acknowledged that economic distress was a price that the Federal Reserve was willing to pay to control inflation. He said, while higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to households and businesses. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation, but a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain. U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered the same story. U.S. markets are bottoming out as they process the latest interest rate hikes from the U.S. Federal Reserve in its battle to fight 40-year high inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 500 points to hit 29,590 at market close on Friday, 24th of September, its lowest point in nearly 2 years. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates in March, the index has lost more than 13% of its value and is down more than 19% on the year. Other indices have followed suit. The Standard & Poor's 500 index fell 65 points to close at 3,693 on Friday, down more than 15% since last March and almost 23% on the year. The technology-heavy Nasdaq dropped nearly 200 points or 1.8% of its value to close at 10,867, down almost 20% since last March. Interest rates have increased to 3.25% since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising them from 0% back in March. This has had the effect of making many goods and services more expensive and driving down demand to bring down inflation.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor, and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the, as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people. As well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution, and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalalip, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News